works across a range of topics, and macromolecules and biointerfaces. We're not really lipid-focused. Our work in membranes, and I'll just show you one slide that corresponds to the abstract so that people don't feel totally cheated, just cheated out of 55 minutes. but we use block of polymers, might have been mentioned before, as lipid mimics. And what you get out of block of polymers is bigger molecular weight and scaling of the thickness, and so we've been studying that for half a dozen years, and I'm going to put one slide on that. But that's on the synthetic side of the lab, and as I work across here to the stem cells, we go from synthetic system to the red cell, which is the simplest biological system. We've already heard mention of it, but I guess I missed a couple of talks in the beginning of the week by David Needham. In that system, we do study spectrins, and I actually have some data on molecules and the latest view of how those molecules work. It's a larger family you'll hear about. But we also look at adhesion proteins there that are part of the immune system and in some sense related to work on that system, or related to the immunological synapse that you heard about from Jay Gross. But I won't go into depth there. I won't tell you anything about the nucleus, nuclear membrane, which we also look at, and the macromolecular aspects of that system. This is a double bilayer system, and there's a lamin network as well as all the chromatin inside the nucleus and attached to the lamin, and made, I guess, some of the first biophysical measurements of the membrane of the nucleus, and there's a lot of activity in that area. Well, what I will focus on is stem cells, which is in the broader class of working the lab on active cells, and in particular contractile cells. And so you'll see a version of this cartoon at the bottom. And there's diseases as well as development and differentiation aspects of the work we do there. So the lab works at the interface, primarily membranes throughout this. But we focus less on lipids, more on polymers and biology. At least one person told me, I don't want to hear about health freak anymore. You won't. But I will have a little bit of math, crude as it is. All right, so this is the one slide on the polymersomes. If you haven't heard of these systems, we're trying to apply these in both for principles and practical reasons. And the basic scheme, and I start with the spirit of a math institute here, applied math, simulations that are done in collaboration with Mike Klein, a physical chemist at Penn, where atomistic approach to these systems is just hopeless. We've gone up in scale with the amphiphile, so you have to develop a coarse grain. This is a rational coarse grain. Potentials here are based on what's done atomistically, and the most recent work has simplified the potentials still and allowed us to look at the dissipating particle dynamics at vesicle processes. But that's all simulation, with the most recent work being membrane protein model-like insertion in these things, in these simulated membranes. The experimental work looks like this. We use the block copolymers illustrated here, a PEG hydrophobic block. Throw it in water, sort of. We really hydrate the same way people do with lipids. And we get vesicles, which you might notice have thickness H that goes thicker and thicker. I don't tell you the molecular weights, but it starts at a few thousand Daltons total molecular weight up to about 20,000 Daltons for this system, and a membrane thickness of about 20 nanometers. So there's many things to do. Among them, address questions with the thinner membrane that we had, whether allomethicin can put a pore in thick membranes. And I'll tell you now, it does. With pegylated thick membranes, it puts a hole in it. Triton does too. Triton's a small surfactant. You just need bigger and bigger concentrations of really what I view this thing, allomethicin, is a genetically encoded detergent. Neutral, thick, it punctures. And these vesicles, as we first described half a dozen years ago, are sort of far more stable in terms of strain that they can sustain than lipids, but they will be ruptured by these same chemical reagents. So this came out, I guess, last year, Jake, this chem, for more details. And so that's principles, if you will, and we have some other projects in that area that are on the website that I can talk to you about as well. And then in terms of practical applications, we make these out of degradable polymers and can shrink tumor cells. So what I really want to tell you, though, is the opposite extreme of what we do in the lab, but it also has a membrane component, because as it turns out, we're really focused on, the story I'll tell you has, think a big picture biology aspect to it that gets into the whole cell and matrix story, but really the main point of importance is again the membrane, but the greater membrane, if you will, the cortical cytoskeleton of sorts, and the local matrix that the cells adhere to. All right, so the big picture math here that I'll touch on as we attempt some probably wrong, incorrect, futile modeling of the biology here is really a mechanochemical principle of sorts. And I'll make an analogy that hopefully clarifies our approach here that applies to cells that look like this rather than red cells, really look like cells that are contractile machines. And I'll start with a vignette on protein extensibility and hopefully quickly getting to the stem cell biophysics. And as I say, it's a focus on the key role of membrane localized elasticity in biology. So channels are in cell membranes for a purpose, and the guts of electrophysiology, because the membrane is a permeability barrier, physically, right? A lipid membrane is a permeability barrier to ions, small and large. Right, so that gives rise to a whole field that has relatively ancient history, many decades old. And the common model, sort of page one model of any electrophysiology chapter, think would include an inert electrochemical model, where the impermeability to DNA proteins inside the cell affects the ions both inside and outside the cell, and so you get, because of the gradient in composition, you affect things outside the cell, and the math here, the voltage that's set up across the membrane relates to those ions and the activity of these channels. All right. So the model here, though, leads to us is associated with some somewhat artificial things that I want you to keep in mind as I tell you to describe our model of mechanochemistry of biology. That is the cell stuff that anion has a charge of -1.2, just to sort of fit the physics. And of course, DNA, none of the proteins really have a charge of 1.2, but there's a whole number of things here that are semi-measured, semi-artificial, but it's certainly a starting point for electrophysiology, and quite successful to understand why there are sodium channels. And there's activity to regulate these channels as well. I mean, metabolic activity, ATP consumption. So this is electrophysiology, and this is the kind of rearrangement you can do of simple equations like that in terms of Boltzmann factor and concentrations of ions. So, and you can get dynamic perturbations associated with action potentials, and one can get deeper into the kinetics, and I don't think anyone was here throughout the week, or will speak tomorrow, maybe I'm wrong, about channel activity and membranes so deeply, right? But that's a whole field, and a well-established field. What I'll tell you about, though, is in terms of mathematics, what we try to learn from that, and what we ultimately want to get is simple expressions like that for the membrane as a barrier, not of this sort, an electric, but as a barrier to stress generation. All right. So the cells are contractile machines, living, generating stresses inside through motor activities, and if that's not already clear to you, I'll give you a better picture of that. And they adhere through adhesive connections to the outside world, that's generally a passive matrix, biologically synthesized protein matrix, so you have a stress-generating gradient. You have strains generated by the cell on itself, as well as strains outside. It's actually the feedback of that turns out to be especially profound in stem cells, what I'll show you. So, to try to relate to what you heard all day, I guess. Lipid bilayers are fluid and don't resist shear, so these elastic stresses, the motor stresses, are obviously going to be generated by proteins, but all the elastic stresses are involving shear and really don't aren't influenced by the lipid bilayer so much as proteins and protein networks and assemblies. So this is much more a talk on proteins rather than on the lipid bilayer. So the lipid bilayer for us is really a partition between an elastic motor-driven structure inside and an elastic structure outside. No motors outside, right? So what in simple physical terms, we view all of this as a bunch of elastic elements adhering together, attaching one to the other. I didn't draw a little motor. I really should add a motor here because that's particularly key. I'll show you. But there's a continuous chain through adhesion proteins, this transcellular adhesive contractile compliant apparatus. And some of these proteins are also signaling proteins that I'll mention here and there. Let me point out that your body cells go to great trouble to engineer this adhesive contractile compliant apparatus. In the biggest gene in our genome, the biggest genome actually, is found in all sorts of myocytes, skeletal muscle cells, hard muscle cells, smooth muscle cells, and a number of other cells. It's called dystrophin. It's the biggest gene known. It's not an enzyme. It doesn't do this or that. It simply is, when you read about this molecule, they'll describe it as an elastic element that's key to transmitting elastic stresses from the highly contractile apparatus of muscle cells, especially to the outside world. It is specialized for muscle cells, but it serves an example that actually cuts across back to red cells as well, tell you. All right. When you're missing this protein, you unfortunately have one of the most common forms of the most common form of muscular dystrophy of death by the age of 20. Your body actually tries to compensate, expresses other proteins, but for unknown reasons, proteins like filamin that I know Alex Levine is thinking about are upregulated by some 50-fold at the membrane, but it doesn't compensate adequately. And as I say, death by the age of 15 to 20 is typical. So what I'll tell you about in biological terms really is just a redefinition. Redefinition of a first page, second page concept in cell biology text. It's long been known that anchorage dependence of the cells I'll tell you about, tissue cells, the anchorage dependence means that cells like this cannot grow in fluid. They can't grow in suspension. They have to adhere to something solid. But we know from the physical chemical sciences that not all solids are created equal, that mechanical properties, among other properties, thickness and thinness of the solids that a cell might attach to are variable across nature.
What do you mean by thick or thin?
So here's sort of the cartoon of what I just said. So if you have a tissue cell in suspension, you really can't. So a muscle cell or any cell from your solid tissue, rather than blood, a cell from your solid tissue, you can't grow it in by stirring it in solution, even if you add things that bind to the. This is dying sufficiently. Even if you, even if you add factors that bind to adhesion receptors, soluble light. No matter what you add, you can't get a cell from solid tissue to survive. But if you provide a surface, a solid that has, intrinsically a solid has elasticity. It can also be a thick or thin solid. In our body, there are things called basement membranes that are protein sugar self-assemblies that might be a micron thick, a few hundred nanometers thick. They're soft, generally soft, wet things, and they have a characteristic thickness. So these are things you can control, the body controls. Basement membranes is a good example. And synthetically, we can also control. And that'll be the point. So cells... Tissue cells, disaggregated from solid tissue, really have to attach to something solid, and it's only now being recognized, data that I'll show you adds to that recognition, that the nature of that solid matters, because there's feedback here. Cells attach and signals go back and forth to assemble the cytoskeleton, assemble the adhesions, really to program the whole genome in the case of stem cells.
But how does the cell know the thickness? I mean, how can program?
I will show you that. Through elasticity, ultimately. So to give you a sense of elasticity at the molecular scale, what limited tools we have, I'll give you a short vignette. It's incomplete. I'll try to make a connection, but I'll really focus more on our understanding of cells, including this question of how and how thick, because it ultimately comes down to at least the supramolecular scale. So the work we do at the single molecule level, I think, is key to providing insight into the question just asked. So in fact, about half of the proteins in the genome, proteome, are multi-domain proteins. I wouldn't say they're adhesions. The small fraction are adhesion proteins, the small fraction are cytoskeleton. But most of them are multi-domain proteins, multi-domain, independently folded domains linked to covalently, right, into a single protein. And they're often, therefore, extensible. Tandem repeat proteins, some of the proteins I'll refer to, show you data for spectrum, filament, I said, Titan in particular, where the experimental work really started on these sorts of concepts. So proteins like this, cytoskeletal adhesion proteins, generally see forces. If that's not clear, hopefully it will become clear as I talk about contraction forces, adhesion forces. A cell is going through the bloodstream, it attaches, and there's stresses, hydrodynamic stresses on molecules that attach one cell to the next. Right. So in particular, we've been interested in, who's mentioned blood cells for 10 or 15 years, and we do a lot of work on the major by mass protein in the blood cell. I mentioned the previous talk, spectrin, which is a multiple repeats of this three helix bundle shown in NMR, one helix, two helix, three helix, helices, loops in between. And in alpha spectrum, beta spectrum, there's between 15 and 20 plus of these repeats all lined up. Actin binding one end is typical of this large spectrin superfamily that includes not only spectrin found in the red cell. Here's some simulations of you. There is a Hamiltonian here, so there's a health thing. I lied, I guess. So we did this half a dozen years ago, but this protein is found in red cells, but it's also found in all your cells, at spectrin is. It's the larger superfamily includes proteins like actinin, which again is found in all your cells. And then I also mentioned dystrophin, which is primarily found in muscle-type cells, heart to smooth muscle, skeletal muscle, which has 24 of these repeats, plus so-called hinge regions, proline-rich hinge regions. And as I said, its absence leads to muscular dystrophy. And the list of these proteins goes on and on, actually. So what's the elasticity of these sorts of molecules? So just to reiterate, dystrophin has an actin binding end that couples to the contractile apparatus in muscle cells. It binds to the membrane at the other end. Its absence leads to disease, largest genome. It's a top 10 genetic disease. There's a lot of work to approach this problem with modern technologies, modern molecular biology, and that includes gene therapies, and some of the latest trials are going, just really started last week in Cleveland, if I'm not mistaken, with mini dystrophins knocking out a whole bunch of these repeats and asking in humans, is that a good idea? And that's, the jury's out. In mice, it looks like maybe sort of okay. What's emerged from studies in mouse is that you can knock out a lot of these spectrin repeats, but most of them are ineffective. The only ones that seem effective are those that have hinge regions between those repeats. And that's probably getting too deep a level of detail here, but the big question for all of these proteins, non-enzymatic, because our kinases, they're structural elastic proteins. What parts of the protein are important contributing to the elasticity to the cell, right? So that's the question we ask. What are the molecular mechanical properties of membrane, localized, spectrin family proteins, dystrophin, spectrins? And so biophysical insights from particularly experiments, but also mathematics, so simulations at least. Right, so one of these simulations I know doesn't work, but we sort of dug most deeply in simulation and mapping out what parts of typical spectrum family proteins here, two repeats connected in series, three helix bundle here, with sort of a surprising structure of a helix that connects to the next repeat. Under stretch, under using steered molecular dynamics. You hold the protein at one end, apply force at the other. This is a technique developed by Klaus Schulten. There's water all around this. It's a pretty massive computation. And not sure if these work so well, these simulations here, but okay, this one works. So it's tethered here. You're pulling, see some unwinding of the helix, but in particular, we were interested, and you'll see hopefully in the slides of the data, the protein unfolds in weird parts. In particular, it unfolds in the middle between the two domains, what ordinarily is sort of the linker region. It turns out to be a mechanically defined linker. We color code according to a sort of molecular scale strength. All right, so that's the sort of things that you can do in simulation. We have a lot of other aspects of that as a function of temperature to relate to the sort of experiments I'll show you here. But what you do in experiments to get a data like that, effects like that, is use sharpened tip AFMs, soft cantilever AFMs, and a technique first applied by Matthias Rieff, Julio Fernandez, and Hermann Gau to type, so less than a dozen years ago. The basic technique is to adsorb or attach protein to a surface, come into contact with the surface, physi-sorb the protein on, typically pull away, and here in the case of a four-domain protein, as you apply force stress to this protein, you unfold the domain. The tips here are about the same size or smaller than the proteins you're pulling on. So this is an exaggeration, of course, but schematically you really do get these effects with data that looks like this for spectrum, much higher forces than what I'll show you here for Titan. Spectrum unfolds at forces that myosin molecules can generate, or a couple of them. So it's a rate-dependent unfolding force, but the basic process, the tip moves away, the force builds up until one of these unfolded domain structures pops open, unfolds. And the forces, as I say, between 15 and 20, 30 piconewtons is typical. Slower rates give you much slower, lower forces. So the way we do these experiments, fairly systematic. We do 5,000 contacts with the surface and build up statistics of these processes. And we
that well, Dennis, please. Can I ask a question about the previous one?
Well, this is the same, so yeah.
Oh. You were fitting your results to the worm-like chain.
Yeah, it's heuristic, you know. Cameron talks to you about this, yeah. But.
So you do that for DNA, but if you normally for proteins, which has flexible peptide groups, more tend to use the freely jointed chain.
No, it's still the worm-like chain is still being applied because the fit really is to the unfolded part of the so you've already unfolded some part is the idea, and then you've unfolded, and it's really the unfolded part that's being fit by the worm-like chain, and the persistence length then is roughly the size of a amino acid.
The worm-like chain has a different divergence of force for its extension.
Yeah, no, you know, it's...
could you distinguish those? Or?
No, not with this protein. And it's not resolved for higher force proteins, like Titan and some of the other proteins that Fernandez worked. So this is such a low force, we focus on asymmetric sawtooths rather than best fits to worm-like chains. As important as I, you know, do think that the data is just too noisy to distinguish these. What is clear, though, when you just focus, as I say, on asymmetric sawtooths is some divergent pathways. There's sort of like skip sawtooths here that really are consistent with unfolding by multiple pathways. Sometimes a single domain unfolds, and sometimes two or three or four domains unfold all at once. The reason is, and this is not found typically, if ever, in Titan molecules or filament, is the connecting linker between these domains in the spectrum family, the dystrophin generally, with some important exceptions here in dystrophin. The linker here is also helical. These domains are connected one to the next by a helix I already mentioned, and so a helix to coil transition in this protein can propagate through that linker and unfold through this pathway at basically the same force as a single domain. Dave?
Yeah,
and
some of the things that Fernandez was doing, we had this earlier, our protein structure, they were beta sheets,
yeah.
Not helices, and now we're breaking, say, five hydrogen bonds at a time,
yeah.
Maybe two hydrogen bonds and then another three.
Yeah.
So that's a different
that's right.
Helix. So at least for the 20 people that were here for the
probed, and I think they tend to be lower forces. It's a different pathway unfolded, but it's early days with this technique. And
yeah.
Say that there's a, I don't think I'll show you data, there's this very strong temperature dependency as well, even to the point of some of these domains unfolding at 37 degrees. So this is a much softer, thermally and in terms of force, kind of protein. So here's some of the data that sort of convinces us that there's multiple pathways here. Here's this sort of single domain unfolding pathway, and for a short construct, the two domain, three, four. So the longer you go, the more pathways you have.
Sorry, what's the peak to peak one?
So this is the distance between the sawtooths.
The peaks of the sawtooths.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
It's not how far.
It's the distance between the sawtooths, right, which is the force peaks. All right, so I think I only have one more slide to show you here. That does this happen in biology? And this hasn't been addressed by Galber Fernandez in any direct way, and so we scratched our heads and we're trying to come up with ways to do this, and I don't go into details here, but this goes all the way to mass spec, allowing us to say exactly where this is happening in a cell. You just put a probe inside the cell that covalently reacts with cysteine groups, SH groups. Shear the cells as a function of at temperature. We do it as a function of temperature, and either with shear or without shear. And the basic material you end up with, you can instantly see, is brighter. You follow through all the way through the gels and mass spec, and we know exactly what sites now are opening up, being exposed to cysteine labeling. This kind of technique might apply, for example, going back to the talks earlier, does allometicin fold or unfold as you go into membranes? Yeah. How do you probe that, directly, right, in situ, in a cell, let alone in a purified? So these are the kind of techniques that really have to be developed to understand conformational changes. The FRET techniques maybe also, but this can be, you can engineer in systems.
So you're shearing the cells? Because of the
in a rheometer, yeah.
Because of the proteins inside?
The probe is put inside, although you can also use permeable probes.
No, I'm trying to
understand
what's going on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The thing inside, you shear the cell and it breaks apart?
This is, yeah. So
why doesn't the cell break apart? It's even bigger.
No, because the shears here are physiological, but you're putting shear on a big surface that gets distributed over many molecules. So certainly you can go to very high shears and rip the cells apart. But at low shears, relative to, these cells are being pumped by your heart through your body, so they're seeing fluid shears of 8 dynes per centimeter squared up to several fold,
yep,
times that.
I was just wondering, if the shears are not big enough to rip the cell apart, then it's clearly not big enough to rip the single protein apart.
No. So the cells are being distorted in the shear field, so they will go from a discocyte to sort of an ellipsoidal shape, and I think even Robin, you worked on that problem, some years ago.
So they'll distort,
they'll become quasi-ellipsoidal under shear, and what happens at the molecular level is locally some of the domains are unfolding, and the cysteine labeling after the fact of these brightly labeled cells really shows that to be.
Marcus is concerned about the fact that the unfolding forces which you are applying to shear flow must be really tiny because the forces are not big enough.
Yeah, they half a dozen picanews.
So have you estimated what kind of forces the shear flow could apply to a single molecule?
I haven't. You just have to go back to sort of the computations like you've done. We started with physiological to ask this question, but we haven't gone back and said what's the average force on the extended spectrum? What are the fluctuations that might be? That's a great STAT-MEC problem. For someone who's looked at this problem before, what are the fluctuations? We've addressed that in some of the micropipette studies we've done, but I don't know offhand. It wasn't the 5 to 10 picogram range, as I recall, when they aspirate these cells, not in the shear flow.
So if you I showed some videos earlier that have been done, and we've done with some red cells, where you actually do a shear, sucking on the dimple shear experiment.
Yeah,
would you start to see this fluorescence appear when you
do that? We haven't done that.
Yeah,
postdoc is been encouraged to do it, but he hasn't done it.
But you would expect to see this. So you see the movements,
yeah,
and with that kind of definition, you would start to see.
Yeah, based on what we've done before. Yeah, we also. Yeah. There's other. Yeah.
How does the probe work to look at the unfolding?
Let me show it in this context. So these folded domains, really made of amino acids, obviously, at low frequency, about 1 to 2%, of the amino acids in these helical domains have cysteines. Okay? And as it turns out, about half of that 1 to 2% those cysteines is a pretty neutral in terms of hydrophilic, hydrophobic characteristic of a cysteine. So the SHs are often pointed in to the core of the folded domain, and half the time, as it turns out, pointed out. So we get some baseline level of the labeling of the SHs, but then when we apply shear, that level goes up and is very temperature dependent, as it turns out also. All right, so this vignette that lasted too long shows that these domains unfold, that structured linkers can unwind and extend and stochastically weaken with force and, I'll tell you, temperature, surprisingly strong temperature dependence here. 37 degrees versus room temperature is a huge difference. And the structured linkers cooperatively propagate the forced unfolding at forces that even myosin, I mentioned myosin, it's one of these motor molecules that becomes key in the story I tell you next. So myosins generate forces through proteins like this, dystrophins, spectrins, right? And I should say we can apply that technique people were asking about to other cell types. We provide these also to stem cells, although I'll show you no data, and to muscle cells. All right, so these sorts of proteins coupled to the motors, to them through the bilayer, through adhesion proteins, integrins, specialized, then to the outside world of matrix and maybe other cell types. So the matrix compliance is, you know, I told you what's going on inside the cell from our narrow little niche in that world of biology. Now I'll tell you about controlling the matrix compliance on the outside and how that influences differentiation, what cells become, from muscle cells to stem cells. And the importance arises because you have a stress gradient, you know, not the ion gradient that leads to a membrane potential, but a stress gradient of a contractile motor-driven cell, you know, and a passive elastic material outside. So the developmental biologists, at least a small handful, a small subset, recognized years ago that cells exert forces on the outside world. So Al Harris, developmental biologist in North Carolina, tailored materials that were soft, and in this case thin enough, to visualize those contractile stresses. Here is a thin silicone film that he put fibroblasts on, and just about any solid tissue cell he put on these thin silicone films would generate wrinkles, and they'd be transient wrinkles. Here, wrinkle, a little less, less so still, and then the wrinkles come back. All right, so this goes back a couple decades. What's new? Well, less than 10 years ago, these films were replaced by, the films were replaced by gels where you could have much better control over the elasticity. So the elastic matrix gels could also be embedded with markers to look at the strains in that sort of way, but there's much better control now of the elasticity, not some ill-characterized silicone film. So this is the sort of strain field that you can calculate, numbers I'll give you later, underneath the cell that's exerting stresses, right? This contractile body on top of a soft material. But the big biological question, is there feedback off the strain field, off the stresses generated? So we have a review on non-stem cell type of cells come out a few months ago. And the pioneer in this field, really, data I think I'll show you soon, is from Yuli Wang, and we picked up on together with a colleague at Penn, Paul Jamny, about 4 or 5 years ago. So the pioneer paper here from Yuli came out in 97, and he used these gels with epithelial cells and fibroblasts, and showed that the cells on stiffer gels tend to spread more than on softer gels. They whether it's epithelial or fibroblasts, they also tend to, I'll show you, organize cytoskeleton more and organize adhesions. They're called focal adhesions, those integrin attachments to the outside world. There are a number of limitations in this study, but it was a great starting point for the field. So as I say, on stiffer substrates, these types of cells spread more, assemble adhesions more. And also, these effects were blocked by myosin inhibition with an early drug that was available back then. So the systems that are used, these gel systems, really become the mainstay, but people have used other materials, us included, are polyacrylamide gels, sort of available in every biology lab, inert if you thoroughly wash it, covalently attached to glass, with, importantly, adhesion ligands attached to the gel surface. So the cells have to adhere to something. They don't adhere intrinsically to these gels. but they adhere to molecular thin layers of things like collagen and other adhesion proteins. So these gels are easy to control through cross-linking this acrylamide and the molecular weight of the acrylamide, the elasticity, over several orders of magnitude, and they're also pretty well-behaved, not highly non-linear, pretty linearly elastic materials over a wide range of strains. So they're relatively good for long-term cell culture that I'll show you results from. So sort of came up, and I'll come back to this at the end, in particular, not only you control the elasticity and what adhesive ligand and density you put on, but you also can control the thickness. And because these are surface materials, you know, we characterize surface materials often by surface probe techniques, scaling probe techniques, and for this includes AFM. So we measure the elasticity by classic Hertz models of indentation, and we do this for various thickness gels, and really show, yeah, we know how to get the elasticity. It's independent of what the ligand on the surface is. All right, so the first cell type I'll tell you about is a simple muscle cell, but it illustrates several points, cleans up, I think, several aspects of this kind of work. It's a smooth muscle cell from arteries. It turns out, just in the first few hours, what do you see? So you add these cells. In this case, they're transfected with a green fluorescent protein, heard from Rob yesterday, green fluorescent protein conjugate of actin. It's a major cytoskeletal protein. And you see, as a function of elasticity of the gel, that the actin at the leading edge is polymerizing much faster on stiffer gel. So actin polymerization rate goes up rapidly, especially at the leading edge. Further back, it's a little bit slower. But still, as a function of elasticity, the cells are much faster in their spreading dynamics on stiffer. And they lay down adhesions more rapidly. You can follow through with other GFP proteins that label adhesions. And you see on stiffer materials, stiff gels and glass, classic sort of integrin clusters, focal adhesions, that you can follow up afterwards with pipette peeling off, and you see that there's nice, very firm attachments, focal attachments that break in a brittle fashion, which contrasts with how the cells adhere to softer gels.
How did you know, I don't know about this experiment, that it is because of the elasticity rather than some other property that you are changing also as you want to change the elasticity?
Hopefully I'll add bits and pieces to that. You know, I wouldn't rule it completely out, but we and others use a whole range of materials and porosity changes, and it looks like that this is the common denominator of explanation.
What about hydration or the water activity?
Yeah. So this changes with the changing acrylamide concentration versus bis ratios, and you pretty much get the same whether it's a 5% gel or a 10% gel, as long as it has the same elasticity.
Okay.
So on a gel, we show by a mechanical technique, a micromechanical technique, something similar to what Yuli showed, that the adhesions are much more dynamic, less focal, and not so brittle in how they detach or are forced to break. The cells are also generating stresses. You can embed beads. A number of people have developed traction force microscopy to look at the strains in the gels underneath the cells. And so these are the sort of strain fields you see under, in this case, muscle cells. These are smooth muscle cells pulling on the gels. And so they're clearly exerting forces on the gels. All right, so I mentioned adhesions are affected. This is data for cytoskeleton as well as cell spreading as a function not only of elasticity of the gel, so three elasticities, including glass, a very stiff material, and also ligand density. And this is among the questions that wasn't addressed until I think this paper came out. Does it maybe this is just a different density of ligand on a soft gel versus a stiff gel? You don't have good control. So we varied the collagen density over a wide range, went to as high as we could on a soft material, and you see that on the softest gels here, cells don't spread, they don't organize cytoskeleton, don't build up adhesions. You cannot compensate for elasticity differences of the matrix through chemistry, adhesive ligands. And there's other consistency checks on this with people overexpressing integrins. No matter how much ligand, the cells on soft gels behave almost as if they're still in a fluid, you know, still suspended in fluid. But they are seeing the solid because they don't die on these soft solids as opposed to, but they do die in when it's grown in suspension for as long as we grow these cells, 24 hours, 4 hours, 24, 48 hours. Okay, so but these snapshots are taken even just with 4 hours. There's also non-linearities here to better understand. Maybe I think the next slide we get into some modeling here of these curves. So we have a crude biphasic model to try to fit this data. So collagen density, which people had focused on with other cells and rigid materials for some time, is one axis. Orthogonal, we're claiming, to now matrix elasticity, due to contractility of the cells, that affects things, as I just said. It most easily measured is projected area of the spread cell, but this axis is basically equivalent. You can come up with various sort of metrics of cytoskeletal organization, adhesion densities, focal adhesion densities. They all tend to show curves on surfaces like this. And the nonlinearities look something like models developed to describe motility also 10 or 15 years ago as a function of adhesiveness, not compliance, but adhesiveness, collagen density again, where cells on very high, cells on surfaces and cells that are motile on surfaces that have low ligands for them to crawl around and don't crawl very fast. But then there's an optimum. At high densities, the cells also don't crawl very fast because they're anchored down. Turns out they have to detach the rear in order to crawl forward. And if there's too much ligand density at the rear of a crawling cell, it can't detach well enough, is the explanation that fits experiments and is relatively well modeled. And the reference here is, DeMillo. Doug Laufenberger and DeMillo, what we're going to say. We're seeing similar nonlinearities here, maybe for similar reasons. Our approach to our own data, though, is somewhat different, and we try to, instead of they developed a kinetic model for them, we try to develop a model in the spirit of what I showed you in the very beginning, a sort of electrophysiology model. We've got, instead of a voltage, we've got a stress, and instead of ion concentrations, we have things like collagen density. Right. So what I just tried to say was, you could rearrange that expression that I did for you for the electrophysiology as exponential of minus voltage times Faraday's constant over RT. So here we have a cell stress over some effective temperature, as it has to be. And then instead of ion concentrations, we've got things like collagen. And I'll give you maybe a more thorough stat-mic derivation of this sort of expression later. There's another model we developed, but we're not alone in this. Unfortunately, I didn't dig into Robin's. You have a paper in this sort of effect, roughly, as Sam Safran has developed a couple years ago now, where you have these sort of adhesive stickers coupled to elastic elements, and you have the same sort of two-term effects of elasticity, obviously, and chemical binding. And so we have, in the same spirit, the same effects in equilibrium as implied here. So his sort of model leads to effects that we see here. Now just as a function of elasticity. What we're seeing as a function of elasticity is sort of classic dose response for hormone binding, or classic biochemistry in a sense. You see linearity at low elasticities and saturation at high elasticities. So I was asked, is this material dependent? So on this curve now is 5% acrylamide, 10% acrylamide, 5% difference in hydration state that extrapolates to glass and also includes a collagen gel. So really essentially four different materials, and they all fit on this one curve. Right. For cell area, but this applies to adhesions as well. This is at 4 hours, it's 24 hours, and this is a cut through the surface I showed you before where we use the optimal collagen density. So these curve shapes are ubiquitous in biology, growth factor binding the receptors, hormones, and you usually see a curve like this and should think, where does the system operate? If this is concentration of a growth factor, your guess should be, so we're taught, often true, that the concentration should be at the half max of this. It's like the volume knob. Who's going to design a TV with you always have to have the volume on max, or all the way down. It's sort of in the middle. That's the point, right? So the systems don't work at saturation, and they don't work at this low response. So when you see a curve like that, that's our expectation. We get these cells from aortas, and we go in and micro measure what the microenvironment of the of those cells what they live in. And it's in that half max range. They're not living on things that are equivalent to the stiffness of glass or hard plastic, or things that are, you know, as soft as spit. They really live in something in the mid range and don't have huge focal adhesions and super organized cytoskeletons that you typically see in cell biology books. It's really in the mid range. And I'll reinforce this point sort of most emphatically with the stem cells, because the bio, the in vivo microenvironment, which just here is a correlation, is the whole story with the stem cells. All right, and the first hint of that, I would say, there was the first hint. This is the sort of second major hint of that with muscle cells, where we wanted to study the same effects, but now with skeletal muscle cells, which turn out to be long, multinucleated cells that typically are very messy to culture. And we solved this by using gels with micro-patterned strips on them. So we get multinucleated muscle cells that we just first showed that these cells exert stresses on their substrates. So this is actually a lift and relax kind of experiment. The cells are exerting stress, so we lift the end and they contract. You contract a little bit and you get these contraction curves, simple exponential type relaxation that depends on myosin motor activity. So this is an inhibitor of myosin. So in fact, it's non-muscle myosin 2 inhibitor. So contractility is there, and this in this case on cells, multinucleated skeletal muscle cells on glass. The biology of the story, though, is so all these cells are exerting stresses on the matrix, and we use different stiffness matrices, and the finding was that the stresses generated and the adhesions there lead to rearrangements inside the cell such that you get the best physiological, biological arrangement of the cytoskeleton on sort of intermediate stiffness gels, similar to the story I just said. But you don't find that same well-organized, striated, well-organized physiologically cytoskeleton on stiff gels or rigid materials like glass, nor on soft materials. So we get optimum cytoskeletal organization on gels of intermediate stiffness that correspond to really the passive elasticity you can measure for muscle. Stiff materials, whether it's a stiff gel or glass, gives you no striation, and soft materials don't either. And in weeks in culture, all in the same medium. Adhesion, though, so this is our optimum for differentiation, the organization of the cytoskeleton. So this was the optimum, and this is what we measure by sort of the micropipette technique for adhesion. So cells on glass have these really strong, crazy glued-like focal adhesions, hard to break, but also very non-labile. Cells like softness and lability, apparently, because you get great adhesion, but lousy differentiation, as we call it. This is striation, this hallmark of muscle differentiation. All right, so stiffness of the matrix out here is key, and for total lack of time, I won't tell you about the signaling studies we do that probably propagate and influence disease states. This is the sort of work going on, and I can tell you about it later. So I've got to tell you in the last few minutes here, it's the stem cell story, right? So this is not typically thought. In fact, no one in the literature has reported this cell to be a contractile cell. Now, what I've shown you is smooth muscle cells, skeletal muscle cells. These are contractile cells. No doubt they have myosin. No one would doubt that. All right? But
so
these.
What's a mesenchymal
thing? So in the world of stem cells, there's mesenchymal and hematopoietic and embryonic. Those are the simplest categorizations. Embryonic is the controversial one at the federal level for reasons you've seen in the press. Hematopoietic have been studied for many decades. And they lead to blood cells, red blood cells. Mesenchymal have been studied for not nearly as long, but they're also actually bone marrow derived, in the bone marrow. And whereas hematopoietic become fluid suspended cells, blood cells, white cells, mesenchymal tend to become solid tissue cells. And the idea that they're there, and I'll reinforce it with a cartoon, is that if you have an injury, to muscle, or maybe you have a stroke to your brain, or your brain, damaged bone, break a bone, other solid tissue, these cells are recruited from the marrow and end up in these damaged organs and differentiate. In fact, that I'll come to that cartoon because it's really part of the story here. So the usual answer, really, these types of mesenchymal stem cells have really been studied for 7-8 years now, and you manipulate media conditions, growth factors, steroids, that sort of thing, to drive these stem cells to become, say, muscle or neurons or osteoblasts or various sorts of cells. Okay, but the physical factors have been largely neglected, in particular the elasticity. So the background slide for this, mentioned in this review here, is to point out that, you know, we can all get X-ray images of our entire body, and you see density, mineral density, or MRIs, and you see something chemical having protons or labels. What we sort of need next, and there is some progress in this with techniques like ultrasound and elastographic MRI. If the biology here is right, then I'm telling you, we really need elastic maps of tissues, but there's some obvious differences. So starting stress versus strain, elastic curves of some representative tissues, brain is softest. Brain is about a kilopascal in stiffness, and muscle is about 10 times that. And bone is very rigid. Bone surface is collagenous layer, is somewhat softer, 100 kilopascal or so, 50 to 100 kilopascal. So we've got fluid and we have solid tissue, but there's a variation in us. It's sort of, as I say, we need an elastographic map of to better understand this, what I'll tell you in terms of differentiation. So this is my color-coded map. Soft would be blue. Intermediate stiffness would be red, and something stiffer would be sort of gray, right? So these cells are recruited from the bone marrow due to damage. You have a stroke, they're in the circulation, they end up in your brain, something like this, right? And they're not always successful, but they in terms of growing back neurons, but they might be, right? So does a stem cell that, as I'll show you, has been reported, if you haven't seen before, can a stem cell that ends up in the brain sort of feel the elasticity of this soft tissue and respond to it, right? I've already said, these kinds of cells regulate cytoskeleton, regulate adhesions, if they have myosins, and the question is that enough to influence them to become neurons or muscle? So the first hint of this, the simple study is same gels, same collagen, same suspension meat, same media that you grow the cells in, with the sort of hierarchy of tissues here, and the same hyperbolic curve is sort of seen for elasticity and, in this case, spreading. But as I say, this is equivalently cytoskeletal organization or adhesions. But what's distinctive about these cells is the morphology. At 4 hours, these cells don't spread a lot, but they're very distinctive versus other cells I showed you in having begin to look like neurite-like extensions. And they become elongated even in a few hours. That is typical of muscle, or on stiff materials, stiff gels or glass, they have pancake shapes. So branched, elongated, polygonal, brain, muscle, bone. We can quantitate this at 24 hours as well, and this is what a neuron has in terms of branch density along its neurites. This is 24 hours, I think, or maybe it's 1 week or two, I forget. And the stem cells don't quite have the branchiness of neurons, but on soft gels, they get halfway there, and the branchiness for neurons as well as the stem cells. And this data is from our colleague, Paul Jeremy at Penn. The neurons and the stem cells are more branched on softer gels, just quantitation of that, and it's blocked by adding a drug that blocks myosins, right? And I'll reinforce what kind of myosins are there. So this now is sort of the spindle shape, how elongated the cells are, so their shape factor in terms of spindliness, and that peaks similar to muscle precursor cells, myoblasts, at the elasticity of muscle. Right. So I've sort of already implied that the cells have myosins, and so this is sort of the first array that I know about looking at myosin content in these mesenchymal stem cells. And all of these are myosin genes, non-muscle myosin twos, B and C, I point out, because those are the muscle, those are the myosins that are inhibited by the drug lemastatin that I mentioned a couple of times now. So the right proteins are there, and the content, both in this is mRNA levels, this is transcript coming out of the genome. Variation with stiffness, this is now protein level, and I'll just say same protein level as well as in the transcript. So the transcript levels vary with stiffness of the gel. So this is clustered, as they say, in a hierarchy according to the variance of the myosin content. You have the biggest variation in this myosin 5B, but high up there are the non-muscle myosin 2B and C, as the most matrix stiffness sensitive. Right? Non-muscle myosin 2A is actually at the bottom. But on average, you get the most myosin expression on intermediate stiffness gels, muscle-like gels, as it turns out that number is. Slightly lower on stiffer gels that prove to be bone promoting, osteogenic. And on the softer gels, you don't have a lot of myosin, but certainly it's non-zero. Right. So the same data is seen at the protein level, I said, and at that muscle stiffness, you even begin to see indications of striation. But the striations have the wrong period. They're not typical of muscle. It's a short period that has to transition to a longer period for it to become really muscle, and that has to occur with a different gene program, different expression of proteins. Then on stiff materials, the myosins appear attached, bound to the stress fibers, you know, all the way to the membrane. Right. So in all of these profiles, as well as the morphology, all of these things are inhibited by blebbistatin, by this drug that blocks myosin. So a motor inhibiting drug blocks morphology, blocks myosin expression, and what I'll show you is it blocks differentiation of stem cells. Okay, so that was the myosin. Myosin's there at the RNA level. It's there at the protein level. It's inhibitable by that drug. But are these cells really behaving like neurons, muscle, and bone? So neurogenic, myogenic, osteogenic markers, typical of early to couple late markers, as we say, at least at the transcript level, were looked at, and on the soft gels, the neurogenic markers show the brightest red, and on the intermediate stiffness gels, typical of passive elasticity of muscle, you see this lane obviously the hottest, and on the stiffest gels, that are surprisingly soft from our point of view for bone development, but we have data now that shows that's sort of the right number within 10 kilopascals. This is the most osteogenic of all of these different markers, which, you know, I only know a handful of them, but these are typically what you find in the literature to characterize bone, muscle,
and what growth factor do you have there? Maybe you said
10% serum for all of these, right? So you have growth factors in serum,
sure.
Right? Just as you have serum in your body, right? And more than at 10%. We're not. I can show you, although I don't think I have in this presentation, what the additional effects of typical induction media are. It turns out to be, well, an interesting additional story to it. So these are all constant media conditions. So here's some heavy breathing here, so I'll try to finish very quickly, right? And so this is protein levels, characteristic of a protein neurofilament heavy chain found in axons of neurons that's clearly upregulated on the softest gels, typical of brain elasticity, or this is a myodia, muscle transcription factor that's highest on a muscle elastic gel, and this is a CBFA1, is an osteogenic bone transcription factor that's highest on stiffer gels, but actually low, it goes low on glass, which is a surprise to us, but as I say, we've actually made measurements now of sort of collagenous bone surfaces, and this is the right range. So the scale here is made relative to protein levels in differentiated cells. So C2, C12, this is a muscle cell line, and you find myod to generally be higher at all on all matrix stiffnesses and higher still on the optimal. So we're not getting full differentiation of these cells due to matrix stiffness alone, and undoubtedly due to other soluble factors in the milieu. This says sort of half the effect, half the differentiation can be just achieved with matrix stiffness. All of this, I said, was blocked yet again by inhibiting mice. You don't get any of these markers to be expressed. Okay, this, I showed earlier, this is just to reinforce, the cells are generating stresses in that underlying matrix. So we've measured, we convert that to a contractile stress in the gels. This is that notion, right? This is not just a voltage gradient across the membrane of a cell, but there's also a stress gradient. You've got a contractile cell, you know, generating these strains. The average stress level in the cell is measured here in units of kilopascal, you know, a few kilopascal. That clearly increases with gel elasticity. So the stiffer the gel, the harder the cell pulls on it, right? So, you know, that should bring to mind molecular activities like unfolding proteins, perhaps, you know, certainly breaking up complexes and driving things to different equilibrium states. So that's the stresses inside the gels. This is the stiffness at the cortex, which we measure by micropipette techniques to measure the elasticity in and around the membrane of these cells. And that also increases units of kilopascal as a function of gel elasticity. And both of these effects are inhibited by inhibiting the motor activity. So the cells are forcing, are pulling harder on stiffer materials, and they become stiffer. So it's like winding a guitar string in some sense. The more stress that you put on it, the stiffer the cells become. So this proves to be something of a universal curve for now the strain inside the cell versus the strain outside the cell. It's like in electrophysiology, you wouldn't get the same curve shape, but you'd plot potassium inside, potassium outside, or something of this sort, and you might come up with a curve under different conditions. So in this case, the different conditions are the substrate, stiff versus soft, instead of inhibiting a potassium channel, stiff substrate versus soft substrate, and it's for the stem cells and all the other cells, right? Just as that electrophysiology model probably applies to these cells and all, you know, it's universal, this behavior seems to be universal. We determine the strain inside just by taking the contractile pre-stress and dividing by the elasticity. Do I have that right? Yeah, right. And the strain outside is directly measured from the traction maps of embedding beads in these soft matrices. So the cartoons here give this sort of picture of that. On a stiff substrate, the cell is contracting against itself, stretching itself with not much contractility of a stiff substrate outside. On a soft substrate, there's more of an equipartitioning, strain inside being maybe similar to the strain outside. All right, so what signals this differentiation as a function of matrix stiffness towards neuro, muscle, and bone? These are three typical transcription factors. And you know, I really don't have a direct answer to that, but we started looking at many of the activators and effectors that you'd find in a typical molecular biology paper, so Rho and Rock and Rack, and this is FAC. So these all vary, again, as a function of substrate elasticity. The variance is what we cluster these by. And they correlate very well with what the literature really would predict, that we would expect something like Rho A to go up in bone. That's what the literature suggests, be low on in brain cell neuronal cells. And maybe intermediate and muscle cells. So we get a very good cross-correlation between, say, osteogenesis and Rho-A expression. Right, so these are some of the soluble activators and effectors inside the cell that are being modulated by their activity, ultimately due to muscle, I should say, mice and contractile activity in these cells. All right, so this has gone way over, I'm sorry, but the sort of model really that I've already shown you before is now developed a little bit more systematically. We have one of these inducible factors, I can't tell you which one, but we view one of them as key and limiting, linked to adhesions, and applicable x sub I to each lineage. And no doubt this is way oversimplified, right? But in the spirit of that electrophysiological model, the Nernst equation, so you can start with a partition function, a molecular partition function in this analysis, and E is not the elasticity here, but the energetics of, let's see, the matrix, no, it is, sorry. It's the matrix modulus that's related to the elasticity of the cell. So this is added in. One gets the from the partition function the free energy that's chemomechanical because it has embedded in it the elasticity of the matrix as well, related to the cell elasticity, and goes through all of this. And so this is the chemomechanical term, and this is then coupled as well to the work done, the contractile work done. Right. So that gives you the same thing I showed earlier, a stress times a volume inside the cell over some effective myosin activity temperature, and this is then the elasticity and collagen, sort of the hyperbolic curve I showed you before. And the product of those two in this sort of way, Boltzmann factor times the chemistry here, mechanically coupled chemistry, gives these two curves individually and collectively a bell-shaped curve that then fits this data. And I went through that way too fast, but can come back to it if there's time for any questions. Each of the parameters there supposedly characterizes the key limiting factor, and we find that these factors scale with elasticity, at least the optimum does. So an effective temperature or an affinity for collagen, cooperativity in the collagen binding, all of these are showing scaling with optimal elasticity. Fractional scaling, even linear. So this maybe just reinforces the differences one sees at the molecular scale. I gave you a bunch of RNA data. This is the adhesion data. Adhesion, focal adhesions become much more prominent on stiffer materials as you go from soft gel to glass. The cytoskeletal organization, just about missing in the neurons in terms of actin organization, becomes much more prominent as you go to stiffer materials. All right, so way back in the beginning, I was asked, why does thickness, thinness, how does this enter in? So we made thin gels. You just embed beads of a given thickness, in this case, several hundred nanometers into these gels. I have to say, it's a bit tricky. We have more work to do. But the data at this point says that soft gels, this is that hyperbolic curve I showed way earlier, soft gels that are too thin allow the cells to feel through it and feel the glass, feel the rigid material below. And it's several hundred nanometers saying that the cells are feeling through soft materials of supermolecular length scales. If the material is soft, if it's too stiff, the cells can't feel through the glass, and you get essentially the same as an infinite material. So the cells are not feeling on their own length scale. They're feeling at the level of that supermolecular adhesion complex. Right, so this is the preliminary results for the stem cells in terms of spreading cytoskeletal organization adhesions. So this is the bottom line for the membrane of a highly responsive tissue cell, a differentiating stem cell. The stem cell is sort of convenient because you have very strong cell state changes that depend on the elasticity of the matrix coupling through the adhesions through these specialized elastic motor-driven apparatus assemblies. So this is work done primarily by a great graduate student, Adam Engler, cell work at least, most of it together with other people in the lab, I should say, people that have left. Maureen Griffin is gone from the list. She graduated a couple years ago. Vanessa Ortiz did the simulations on the spectrins together with Mike Klein. She's co-advised. And Rich Law and Nishant did many of the experiments. There's one. Okay. So a large group of people involved in this.